All statements, views, and opinions are personal and do not represent the United States government, the Department of Defense, or the United States Army. Welcome to the Center for Army Lessons Learned podcast, Insights from the Fight, the podcast dedicated to bringing you lessons learned from exercises, warfighters, and Army fielded forces. I'm your host, Mr. Jeremy Sturmer. Today, we're discussing lessons learned from the Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Center, JPMRC. Joining us is the commander of the ops group, Colonel Matthew LeClaire. Colonel LeClaire serves as the commander for the 196th Infantry Brigade in Hawaii and is the commander of the operations group, COG, for JPMRC. Sir, could you share a brief overview of your background and what led you to be selected to your current role?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. First, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk here today with you. I appreciate seeing you out here with us at the last rotation. You know, it means the world to us when folks come out here and kind of see it. Hearing about these things, one thing, but, you know, seeing a picture's worth a thousand words, but a video is worth a million. So having you out here with us was important, and I appreciate the opportunity here to talk a little bit today. My name is Matt LeClaire. Again, I'm the commander for the operations group, the COG, for the Army's newest combat training center, JPMRC. I'm also the commander for the 196th Infantry Brigade out here in stationed at Fort Shafter and Schofield Barracks here in Hawaii. I've been in the Army my entire adult life. Since I was 17 years old, I came in the Army as an E-1 private, stayed through sergeant in the Rangers, and then moved on to a lot of different units in the Airborne, the 82nd, the 173rd, back to the Rangers. I had commanded a battalion out here in the 25th Infantry Division, and then after that, I was selected to become the commander of the 196th and the COG for JPMRC, so I've been doing both of those now for about a year and a half. I see our purpose and my purpose out here to help people become better warfighters and help them prepare to fight and win in combat.
Excellent, sir. As you mentioned, I recently observed the JPMRC 2601 rotation there in Hawaii. I was there with a number of the Centers for Excellence who were trying to collect on some of the lessons from the exercise and the implications for the broader Army. For our listeners who may not be familiar with JPMRC, can you explain a little bit about the mission and the design of your organization?
The overall purpose of all of the combat training centers is two reasons. Number one, foundational leadership development. And number two, to validate formations and new equipment for the Army. Here at JPMRC, the Army's newest regional training center out here in the Pacific, and by regional training center, what we mean is focused in the region with our partners and our allies and the units that are here in the region. Our box is the region. It's Hawaii, it's Alaska, it's the Philippines, Australia, Malaysia, Indonesia, all the countries that are in here at the invite of our partners and our allies that are out here. Our box is wherever the combatant commander needs that training and that readiness to be built and projected, that's where our combat training center goes.
Sir, also, if you could you expound a little bit about how that mission supports the Indo-PACOM theater and how it supports the Pacific Pathways mission?
Yeah, so what we start off with, the Indo-PACOM commander and his theater campaign plan for the region. And then through that, United States Army Pacific, through Operation Pathways, decides where we can get the greatest bang for our buck with exercises and training and rehearsing with our partners at the invite of our partners in the region, where they could use us, where they need help, where there are gaps. We use Operation Pathways as a way to build that readiness and project that readiness into the region with our allies. Where JPMRC comes into this is what's called our exportable capability. And that is our ability to bring the effects of a combat training center anywhere throughout the region to those countries. And those things that make it a combat training center, make it feel like a combat training center, are what we call the pillars of a CTC. And just for a couple of those are things such as instrumentation. Those are things such as an operational environment or a scenario that gives the soldiers that are part of that exercise and that training something to use towards their planning and a realistic opposing force. Each time we use a different unit, we do not have a professionalized opposing force, but what we do is we train those units to help the units achieve what we call their training objectives.
Okay, sir. You mentioned the regional aspect, the expeditionary role, if you will, of how you guys support exercises. Each year you do an exercise in Hawaii. Each year you do an exercise in Alaska, very different environments. And then you talked about the fact that we go out regionally across the international dateline and provide those exercises in our partnered countries. What are some of the challenges that you have to address in order to be able to deliver that quality training to so many different locations? And how have you organized to kind of accomplish that mission?
The greatest challenge that you have with doing it in so many different locations starts off with the ability to simply deploy to that area with a scenario and plan it. We have what's called our JELC cycle, and it's a cycle for planning for each of these exercises. The Alaska, the Hawaii, Philippines, Australia, Malaysia, every one of these exercises or training is in a different stage of planning at any given moment. Some are in their initial stages, some are in their main planning, and some are in their final planning. And then one of them's usually in some form of execution. And so you have to go to those locations, you have to do the rehearsals, you have to get with the host nation, figure out what training areas can be used and which ones can't be used. And so every one of them requires almost a starting over with each plan, not from scratch, but starting over each time and with the training objectives, the training unit, and what they want to accomplish with that exercise and having to plan it. There's very little cookie cutter, if you will, the ability to kind of replicate the exact same thing in each one of these. You can imagine the scenario that we do in Hawaii and the environment that we do it in the gulches and in the jungle is significantly different than what we'll do here in February in Alaska in the Yukon training area, where with feet of snow and different types of equipment for the 11th Airborne Division. And then this summer we'll go to the Philippines, another jungle, but it is slightly different, the jungles of Hawaii, primarily because you're so far away from everything. Logistics becomes a lot bigger of a situation where if you don't bring it with you, it's not easy to get the equipment or the supplies to the troops that are forward.
So as you've talked about some of the things that you've seen in the jungle warfare, what are some key observations you have for units that may be operating in those jungle or dense environments that commanders need to be aware of as they prepare for and get ready to execute that training beyond what you've already talked about?
Yeah, I think when it comes to the jungle and it comes to the Arctic or the west of the international dateline, some of the even more restricted terrain, I think what first you got to talk about is the things that are common to every one of them. The things that you have to do right no matter what the terrain is, and that's what we're learning. And some of those things I'll hit on real quick. Reconnaissance and security. You must understand where the enemy's coming from. You can't be surprised by them or the size of the unit that's coming at you. You have to establish a culture of fires. And what we mean by that is you have to use your indirect fire, both at your level and then at the higher echelon level, to shape the enemy before you make contact with them. You must shape that. You must contact that you need before you send your soldiers in there to conduct either a company attack, battalion attacks. The third one is field craft and your ability to sustain yourself and survive in the field. It's slightly different in the jungle, yes, than it is in the Arctic, but those that can't simply survive, whether it's food, water, cold, dealing with the rain, going across rivers in the Arctic, in the jungle, if you can't survive, you sure as heck can't thrive in a combat environment. The units that do rehearsals and that practice these things back home before they go to a combat training center, before they go to an exercise, it's obvious who practiced those things before they showed up. And those who are deliberate about the enablers and the special units that they get, the units that embed those enablers weeks and months before they come to an exercise or a rotation always do better than the ones that showed up 3 or 4 days before the exercise, go right into the field. They don't even know each other's names. Those are some of the most common sustains. For the approves, as easy as it would be to say that the units that struggle just don't do those five things well, they are similar. But units that struggle and could do better with communication often has to do with it's more important what you communicate than it is how you communicate. A lot of units will spend a lot of time trying to figure out what radios, what frequency, what type of computers, what type of software they're going to use to communicate. But then once they get into the exercise, they get into the field, now they start tweaking what they actually communicate back and forth. I would argue that what you communicate is more important than how you communicate it. The units that struggle with field craft, the units that struggle with just how to operate in the field, a lot of casualties simply come from their ability to sustain themselves and take care of themselves in the field. Units that struggle with transitions, and that's going from the offense to the defense, from the defense back to the offense, gaining and maintaining contact with the enemy, critical. And then some of the fighting products. You hear this a lot, but a lot of times it becomes, well, what are the fighting products and how do I even use them? We do what's called the leader training program and in preparation for these exercises, and we focus on those, the military decision-making process, but it's to generate those fighting products, and that's the operational graphics, the common operating picture, a decision support matrix and a sync matrix, your fires matrix. But ultimately, the units that do well are the ones that have the ability to take PIRs and priority intelligence requirements and answer the questions rapidly that are from their decision support matrix, turning those into information requirements, putting named areas of interest out there on the battlefield, and then executing reconnaissance and security and using their forces to answer those questions, find the enemy, are the ones that become the most successful.
Okay, sir. I'd like to kind of stay on some of the unique things that JPMRC provides. One of the things that I found very fascinating is that because you're operating there in Hawaii, your ability to engage with the joint force, Air Force, Navy, Marines, and actually operate in a maritime environment is unique compared to the other CTCs. Can you discuss how this joint approach has evolved and how it supports the training for not only Army forces, but the entire Indo-PACOM theater?
Yeah, starting at the lower levels, there's training opportunities because we are this close to the Air Force and the Navy and the Joint Force. They wouldn't exist if we didn't have these habitual relationships with the Air Force. For example, on this last rotation, we had 13 C-17s, we had multiple fixed-wing aircraft, fighters coming from here in Hawaii because, one, they're stationed here. Two, they also had a concurrent exercise that was happening in the month of November, and we were able to synchronize that months in advance with this rotation. Those C-17s we were able to use for the 11th Airborne Division to do airborne operations. We were able to move troops from Oahu to the Big Island of Hawaii and back and forth. We were able to do high mobility movements to other islands throughout the Pacific, Wake Island, the employment of HIMARS at long distances. Because we had the Air Force with us, we're able to do this similarly when we get to Alaska, use it with the 11th Airborne Division. Again, having those habitual relationships allows us to deploy from J-Bear up into Fort Wainwright and back and forth. And then when we move to the Philippines, again, the ability to get personnel and equipment to and from the Philippines, the ability to get our equipment from Oahu to the Philippines. That's the kind of training that is necessary to do in these exercises. We figure out where the gaps are, where the struggles are, how much longer it takes to move equipment down to Hickam Army Airfield, how do you get it prepared and shackled in, and the right level of cleanliness in order to get it on the C-17s in order to get it to these locations. Just talking about those things isn't going to get the soldiers and the teamwork that we need. Actually going through those rehearsals, it was critical this time so people could see where the gaps are in preparation for future exercises and then learn from them and start preparing for the next ones.
Yeah, so the other thing I found interesting is even though that you are training a brigade during your exercises, the support that you get from the division and their enablers in participating in the exercise because you're doing it there with them, because it's supported by the COCOM commander in terms of what you are providing to the force, the training that's occurring not only between the joint force, but between our international partners whenever they're a part of that exercise, it seems to work very well and is very unique to your CTC. Can you talk a little bit about how, as you've stood up this organization, you've been able to have great relations with both the 11th Airborne Division and 25th ID in terms of how they're able to participate in your exercises and bring that realism to the brigade that's training within the exercise?
Yeah, right now, both the brigades here in the 25th Infantry Division, and now their DeVardi is going what's called the continuous transformation and the transformation in contact. And because of that, there is so much training or transformation happening here in the 25th, and we are taking what we're learning from the 25th to the 11th. Both divisions, right, with the division being the unit of action now, what we found is that you can't simply take a brigade combat team, put it into the box, and expect it to be successful, all right? Because of transformation in contact, the brigades are reliant from an intelligence standpoint, from a support standpoint, and from a indirect fire standpoint, they are dependent on their division headquarters to provide those resources to them. And so when we provide them during the exercises, it's necessary for a portion of the division headquarters to help synchronize that support, the fire support, the sustainment, the intelligence, to allow them to be successful. It requires that division to be a part of it. And so we recognized that about a year and a half ago with both of the divisions. And now every exercise that we do with JPMRC, there is division involvement. There is either a division in the dirt, a division in the jungle, division in the snow, where there is the division and those enablers to allow the brigades to be successful while they're out there fighting the fight.
Sir, you've gave me a great opportunity to transition into talking a little bit about some of the TIC, Transformation in Contact 2.0 things that you've seen as our fielded forces begin to continue to receive new equipment and transform. We'll talk through a couple of these over the next few questions. One of the things I'd love to talk about is the transition from the light brigades to the mobile brigades with the equipping of the infantry squad vehicles and the other vehicles that allow those units to be more mobile. What are some of the big things that you've seen as successes and best practices from units that have made that transition, and what are some challenges that their commanders still need to consider going forward?
The first thing about the continuous transformation is that it's more of a mindset than it is a list of tasks that needs to be done. We will continue to transform and modernize the brigades. Simply by adding new equipment to the formations isn't going to modernize them. How they use the equipment and how they modernize it to do what we had talked about earlier, the things that every brigade must do in order to be successful on the battlefield. The things that have come to the forefront is the ability to be more mobile and the ability to shorten the kill chain are the two things that have fundamentally changed the brigade and its ability to fight. The ISV has made the brigade so much more mobile, and the ability to get to points of to key terrain and dominating terrain much faster than they were able to even a year or two ago. It's simply a game changer that we have so many ISVs that they all look about the same, that anybody, they're so easy to operate. They give the ability to power whatever equipment that they need to be powered from. And they're not so key and critical that they can't be left on the side of the road as company begins to move forward at their line of departure. They can simply leave their rucksacks and their equipment with the ISV and move forward. And they're so interchangeable. I can't speak highly enough about that in the mobility. If I had to speak about mobility in the Arctic, the CAT-V has become the ISV of the Arctic, and it's the ability to put large amount of troops into these track vehicles with a trailer and move them rapidly from multiple kilometers in the Arctic. One rotation in the Arctic will show you how hard it is to move a company or a battalion if they're on foot moving across the snow, simply to be able to survive, never mind to be able to thrive and fight. But the CAT-V and that equipment, it allows them to quickly load up, move a company or multiple companies in a matter of minutes and an hours instead of days to a point of domination, key piece of terrain. From a shortening the kill chain perspective, the game changer, I could talk about a lot of pieces of equipment, whether it be the use of small UAS, multi-domain operations, equipment, electronic warfare equipment that allows the front line of troops to simply determine where the enemy is, detect them, and then to be able to place indirect fire or direct fire on the enemy and begin to shape the enemy. It's much faster because from the person that's able to see it to the person that's able to approve the indirect fire, we've been able to shorten that kill chain with a lot of that new equipment. Those are two of the biggest game changers for both environments.
Okay, sir, you've talked a little about proliferation of unmanned aerial systems at various echelons for us. What is the challenge for commanders as they try to integrate those systems and still conduct ground reconnaissance to be able to see and understand the enemy?
Yeah, the first is that it's not one or the other. It's not use drones or use ground reconnaissance. The answer is yes. The answer is both. On the days where it was raining or in the Arctic where there's 40 mile an hour winds, you must have ground reconnaissance and then to identify where the enemy is. But on the days where you can fly and you can see at longer distances and at longer ranges to identify where the enemy is, you absolutely want to tie those two together. So the answer is you must do both and synchronize both. Next, when it comes to the small UASs, we are moving in the direction of they need to be treated more like an ammunition and not worried about if it breaks or if it gets detected or if it gets shot down or if we lose it, whether it because of the winds or the trees or the weather. We have to be able to almost pull that out of an ammo can. You have to be able to operate it. It needs to be easy to operate. It can't take weeks and months of training for the small UASs in order to get it out there at distance and be able to confirm some of the things that you would have wanted to do. You would do it with your own eyeballs or with your binoculars and get within those distances. But if I can remove that from being necessary and use those drones, that's what we're trying to train and not worry about if it breaks and if we break it or if we lose it. We have to have a lot of them. We learned that in the last rotation, that if we're going to employ these at the scale and at the pace at which we want to, we're going to need a lot of them. And we're going to have to be prepared for them to break when our soldiers employ them, and they can't be afraid to employ them.
Continuing on the discussion of unmanned aerial systems and those robotics that are going to be showing up out there in the battlefield, we know that our enemies are also developing those systems. You've talked a little bit about how units have to practice the field craft at the individual levels, from the smallest echelon at the team, the squad, up. Talk about some of the challenges with enhancing force postures, enhancing survivability for our forces, is trained at your CTC, and how we try to create those ideas within our soldiers' head of what they have to do to be successful in an environment where those things are going to be used against us as much as they may be used for us.
Yeah, so it starts with, we have worked really hard, and all the CTCs are working really hard. General George has asked us to modernize the CTCs and to focus on a more modern enemy threat and replicating an enemy threat, multi-domain operations, as well as the small UAS, just two examples, replicating the enemy fires. So it starts with, we have to replicate the enemy threat that we want to give this signature to the rotational unit so that they can then practice it, right? Things like small UAS coming at them. It's hard to determine which ones are yours, which ones are friendly, and which ones are going to be the enemy. That's a challenge we're going to have to go through. So how do you determine which one's which? How do you stay spread out? How do you camouflage yourself? How do you not be detected? And if you are detected, how do you survive because you're spread out? Not everything looks exactly the same, right? If everything looks like 3 to 4 vehicles with about 15 to 20 people, it's hard to tell which one is a POC or which one is a command post or which one is a logistics node if all of these nodes look relatively the same. So we replicate the enemy threat. We send drone swarms against them so the soldiers can see what that feels like, hear it as it's coming in on them, and then work through their procedures either to shoot down the drones, to knock them out of the sky, or survive in the event that they make their way through.
Okay, so we talked about the idea that maybe drones are going to be more of an expendable item, that we're going to deliver it to the soldier. If they happen to lose one, there'll be another one available. It kind of leads us into a conversation about sustainment. Certainly in the Arctic environments, we expect those to be much more dispersed geographically, potentially. But in the jungle environment, we have restrictions based on the terrain that impact the way that we're doing operations. Talk a little bit about some of the sustainment things that you've seen change and what we still need to work on going forward to make sure the force can project forward.
I think the first thing when it comes to sustainment is this the understanding that if you don't have the sustainment there with you days before the need or weeks before the need, like, you can't assume that it's going to get there to you. Therefore, I think everybody needs to be more predictive. Everybody needs to understand what they might need at what given time and be able to kind of move some of those resources forward on the battlefield to a location where it can be moved quickly if needed. It can't be another island away. It can't be multiple islands away. We are seeing now the desire to not have to transload some of these supplies or logistics. Every time you have to take it off one vehicle and load it up onto another vehicle or download it, that's the kind of time the sustainment becomes vulnerable. We lose the ability to keep track of it, about what's needed and at what location. And so a lot of our sustainment units right now are simplifying similar equipment, similar types of loads, so that, again, they don't have to transload it 3, 4, 5 times to get it to the point of need. Is something that we're kind of working through right now. Predictive logistics is the key.
Okay, sir. I'm going to stay kind of in the sustainment realm, and we'll talk CASEVAC for a few minutes. So when we look at casualty evacuation, you and I both grew up in the Army in the 90s, and you at the unit level were responsible for doing a lot of the activities to get casualties back to level 1, level 2 care. Those were really well-rehearsed, well-understood processes in the Army of the 90s. As we went into the global war on terror, we were able to dominate the operating environment. And we were air medevac within an hour was, you know, kind of the standard. And that's not necessarily going to be true within the flot, but there's still a requirement for the unit to look after those soldiers that are injured with point of injury care, and then to be able to evac them back using their own organic systems. If you can, talk about some of the things that you've seen with that and where we need to continue to improve in the understanding of the forces in order to be able to execute that successfully in a LISCO fight.
I've heard a lot of talk about this and about how much of a challenge it's going to be and how much we need to get this mindset that we're not going to be able to evacuate casualties within an hour. I'm just not seeing it. What I'm seeing is platoon sergeants and first sergeants evacuating their casualties off of the tactical edge in minutes, using ISVs, using any means necessary to get their soldiers to the next level of care, to the level 1 and the level 2 care at the battalion level, in less than an hour. And what that's doing is it's moving some of these folks forward in order to provide that medical care that they need to stabilize the casualty, to then rapidly move him or her back to where soldiers potentially could get onto a helicopter and get to level 3 care. We're not seeing the level of, you know, died of wounds or inability for our units to get their people off of the battlefield. I'm seeing some incredible work by those NCOs and our medics out there to bring the care to the point of need, or to get them to that point of need rapidly, so that the unit can continue to fight forward and kill the enemy as they're moving forward. And so I'm very impressed with what I'm seeing in both the jungle environment and in the Arctic by pushing some of those providers a little bit forward and getting the level of care what we need. The second thing I'm seeing is I'm seeing commanders simply not exposing their soldiers and their companies to a buzzsaw. They're not sending their soldiers in there just to be losing them by the hundreds. They're setting the conditions before they move those companies into position. We're keeping the battalions and the sustainment nodes spread out into clusters so that if we do get hit by indirect fire, we're not losing hundreds of soldiers at a time. And we do have the resources in order to sustain them and provide them. And then lastly, I'd say is that we are training the soldiers with the old combat lifesaver, the ability to put on a tourniquet, the ability to triage, the ability to save your teammate's life right there on the cutting edge, and then getting them back to provider to provide the next level of care in order to save their lives.
Sir, earlier you mentioned your leader training program. As you look at preparing the staff to come in and execute the exercises, what are the things that you advise trainers to prepare them for when considering the military decision-making process or how they're going to execute their troop leading procedures that units can address and train for so that when they show up at a CTC rotation or a real-world deployment, they're ready to execute that mission orders process in a timely and effective manner for the commander and the unit?
Yeah, a couple things on leader training program. How we have at JPMRC slightly changed the way we approach this. First, we bring the leader training program to the unit instead of having the unit come to us. We bring our coaches, to Oahu. We did it at Bellows with the Bronco Brigade. We went to Fort Wainwright and did it with the Arctic Wolves out there in their area. We did it with 2nd Brigade of the 11th Airborne at Jay Bear. Colonel Howell said it best. He said, when the attitude is right, the location is irrelevant. And when the unit has the right attitude, the attitude of learning, the attitude of preparation for their future rotation or deployment, where exactly they do it is irrelevant, and they have that right. Second thing we're doing is we are using the environment in which they're going to be going into as the foundation for the training. So we use the terrain. In Alaska, we use the Yukon and the Denali training areas. Those are the maps that we're using. The scenario that they are developing is not exactly the same scenario that they'll be executing and asked to do for their rotation, but it's very similar. And so that they can use that to do the terrain analysis, preparation, time distance analysis. They can understand what it's going to take, where they think the enemy might hide in those training areas and in those areas. It allows much deeper preparation for the exercise. We use the Philippines, we use Oahu, we use the Big Island. The next thing our coaches do is they come to the exercise and see from cradle to grave how the unit is doing. They have a relationship, the coaches have a relationship with those battalions and the staffs. They're the ones that taught them and helped them prepare. They're the ones that come and do some of the reminders and ask them how it's going during the rotation. And then we follow up with them after the rotation as well. So that's not just a one and done, train them for 3 or 4 days and then send them on and say good luck. We have a vested interest in them being successful. We also live with them. At JPMRC, we have 2 battalions that are stationed on Oahu with the primary responsibility of the relationship with the 25th Infantry Division and their sustainment brigade. We have a battalion that's stationed in Alaska who's got the primary responsibility and relationship with the 11th Airborne Division. Then we have a battalion who's stationed in Guam with the primary responsibility of the west of the International Dateline exercises. But each of those battalions, as part of their 196 mission, also has a relationship with the Compo 2 and Compo 3 units in Hawaii, Alaska, and Guam for their preparation. And we just most recently incorporated an MP company from Guam who went through a mobilization exercise from Guam, came here to Hawaii, and incorporated them into the 25th Infantry Division's most recent exercise.
One of the things that I've been impressed with how JPMRC operates is your integration of data into the observations and the lessons that you're trying to provide to your training audiences. What insights can you share on how you built a culture of systems that effectively collect information and then synthesize that data in ways that are useful to you and to the commanders that you're training in order for them to be able to see themselves as they're going through an exercise?
Sure. The first rule of numbers is that you can always make the numbers and the data say whatever you want. We want to measure what matters. We are on a mission to figure out what things are the most important for us to be measuring as OCs and those metrics that are out there that really tell us whether or not units are being successful. What we're also finding is that nothing can replace the judgment of an experienced OC, which is why we select the most capable people to come to the combat training centers and be OCs, people that have done these jobs before, because there's no way to simply replace that judgment that someone with years of experience who's done the job. You know, if I, for example, I just turn to our senior fire support officer and I ask him, hey, is this unit being effective with their indirect fires? He knows what things to be looking at and assessing, their target list worksheet, how they're doing their target rehearsals, how they're doing their technical rehearsals at the artillery companies and batteries, and to know whether or not they were successful. Are they hitting the targets that they intended to hit? He's able to use his judgment and provide us with that feedback through the data, what we call our data assessment tool. It's not just calculating the numbers. It's the context that comes from the OC who's on the ground, combining what we see with some of that data with their judgment and be able to provide feedback on is that unit being successful? And if not, what modifications could they be doing in order to be more successful? He can make that on the spot update and coaching and not wait for an AAR to tell a unit what they could have done better or what they should have done better. A good coach is someone who anticipates where they're going to have friction and allows them to kind of learn on the spot, make those improvements, and see it while they're out there during the exercise and during the rehearsals.
Sir, you've talked about some of the challenges you have as the 196th Brigade Commander of bringing your forces together to support the exercises. You also rely on bringing in some additional cadre, often from Fort Polk or from Fort Irwin, to help round out as your TDA continues to grow to be able to match the mission that you have. From your perspective as a leader, how do you bring that team together and make sure that they're all following with your vision for what JPMRC is supposed to represent and are all providing the level of training that you think is required in order to allow the units that are to be the most successful prepared for future fights?
I'll start by going back to something I said a little bit before. What you communicate is more important than how you communicate it. And I think the what we communicating is what we're doing right now. We're sharing with you in every way possible with anybody that could ever be a part of JPMRC, whether you're a rotational unit or you're an OC or an enabler or an augmentee that comes to these exercises. It's how do we create as many ways for them to learn in preparation for that event. It's not a 700-page op order with every single detail. It's not an OC handbook that is 80 pages that goes through in excruciating detail the X-row perfectly for how to adjudicate a one-way attack drone. Yes, those things are, that is what we're working towards, and those are the things that are helping us. But what it is we must reach out to the units earlier. We must figure out who it is that's coming to the exercise. We've got to figure out how they learn. We've got to be able to communicate with them often, establish habitual relationships with people that are coming out here. We've got to harness the people that are wanting to join this organization, people that were highly successful during a rotation, that were highly successful at using some of this new equipment. Have them come to JPMRC or JRTC and be an OC. And now we have that institutional knowledge. Now we can update our X-Row books, update the OC handbook, help figure out what matters. And if you only had a few minutes to onboard somebody, which always happens, somebody finds out 2 weeks before an exercise that they're going to be an OC. How do we get them a tablet? How do we get them the right access to the right equipment in order to see the common operating picture? How do we get them a digital version, a hard copy when they show up? How do we give them a 15 to 20 minute onboarding class? How do we give them a 2 hour onboarding class? How do we give them updates throughout the exercise in our morning battle rhythm, set 07 and 1600? It's all of the above. There is no one panacea for how to prepare units for a rotation, for preparing OCs for each one of these rotations. It's a combination of all of the above, a relentless amount of energy towards helping to prepare for each one of these exercises, which is making these units successful and making us successful rotation after rotation.
As we've talked about, communicating being one of the things that commanders have to do in order to share the mission and their intent with their subordinates, but also be able to synchronize operations. If you could talk a little bit about the struggle between analog and digital products, about making sure that products are issued to units in a timely manner so that they can have the time to do the rehearsals to be successful. And are there things that the unit can do in preparation during training to be better at those kind of activities?
Yeah, from an analog and digital, you have to do both. You can't do one significantly more than the other. What we found is that with the digital systems, it allows units to put way too much information onto one piece of paper or one common operating picture or one television screen. And it becomes overwhelming for the tactical edge if they even are able to see it. And then the disparity between the digital picture and the analog picture, it's so drastic. It's that there's so much detail in the digital version and so little detail in the analog version when it's done poorly. And so what we need to start with is the basics. What does the unit need to know? They need to know their boundaries. They need to know where you think the enemy is. They need to know where the frontline trace of the friendly units on their left and right are. They need to know their graphic control measures, their fire control measures, where the targets that are available to them are, where those range rings are. Those are the basic things that need to be on an analog picture, an analog COP for a common understanding. And then you move towards the digital and you amplify what was coming off of the analog COP. Because at the tactical edge, the companies don't have access to all of that digital information. They need to know what time it is. They don't need you to build them a watch. They just need to know where you think the enemy is, where the friendlies are on their left and right. And then the last thing I'll say about that is the tried and true one-thirds, two-thirds rule, the ability to get out a simple plan and then violently execute it is still, it's tried and true. It's the most basic. You have to get a basic plan out to the front of the troops as fast as you can so that they can execute some bottom-up refinement back to you. One-thirds, two-thirds rule, it still applies, still out there.
Maybe it was luck. Maybe it was the way you look at the Army and our relationships with our NCOs, but every time I saw you when we were at JPMRC, your sergeant major was pretty close at hand coming in or going out. Talk a little bit about how the best units utilize their NCOs, how the NCOs can empower their units to be successful.
We could do a whole podcast on simply how to use the backbone of the Army and the NCO Corps. When you talk about the being brilliant and the basics, it doesn't get much more basic than fire team live fire, squad live fire, react to contact into a platoon live fire, create an L shape on the enemy, support by fire, establish the base of fire, and then assault the enemy once you have the right conditions. At every echelon, you're trying to do the same thing. You're trying to put two companies against a couple of platoons. You're trying to put a couple of battalions against a couple of companies that are out there. So the foundation starts with the sergeant, with the E5 and the staff sergeant that are down there. If you're not doing at whatever echelon you're at in order to make those sergeants and staff sergeants successful on the battlefield, I would take a second look at what it is we're trying to do, right? So it starts with that, with making them successful. When you do that, they're going to give you feedback on where they need help, and they're going to give you feedback on what equipment's not working, what techniques are not working, what help they need. I need to get to a location faster, whether it be through an ISV or through a helicopter. I need to get to this. This is where I think I need to be in order to execute the mission at which you've given me. When you listen to the NCOs, a lot of times they provide the feedback on what would be successful. They're the common sense managers, right? The platoon sergeants and the first sergeants are going to tell you what they need to evacuate those casualties faster. I need you to move your casualty evacuation point to here. I need you to have level 2 here. This is how I think I can get them to this location at this amount of time. That's how you empower the NCOs. You make them be a part, and you allow them to be a part of the solution. And that will motivate them, that inspires them to provide you with answers that they're the experts on doing, because that's what they've been doing since they were a private when they first came in the Army. And I know I only talked about infantry, but the same goes for our field artillery and for our combat service and support and our logisticians that are out there and our signaliers. I could go into any one of the branches and say that the NCOs and then the warrant officers, the NCOs that became warrant officers, those are the experts. It starts with incorporating them at the beginning. We've made a huge push to incorporate all of the NCOs into the leader training program. Now that we bring LTP to the location, there's no excuse why they can't be a part of it. And they don't have to be a part of everything in the leader training program. So those are just a few ways that I think reinvigorating, you know, the warrior ethos and the backbone of our Army in order to make them successful. That's what we're doing out here in the Pacific. I see it every single day with the 25th Infantry Division and the 11th Airborne Division, and soon to be with the 7th and 4th ID, because that's who USERPAC will be now supporting, and JPMRC will be supporting those divisions as well throughout the region.
Thanks for your time today, sir. Before we conclude, do you have any additional observations or final thoughts that you would like to share with our audience?
Yeah. One, I want to say thanks to anybody that's still listening at this point. If anybody's still listening at this point of the podcast, it's either my mom or somebody that's a close friend of mine or an absolute true believer in becoming a better warfighter and becoming a better leader. I got a couple points. The fundamental purpose of a combat training center is leadership development and then validating the formation and the equipment on whether or not it can do what it's expected to do. That's why we do the CTCs. That's why you go to a CTC. And if you ever want to be a part of one of those two things, there's no better place in the Army to do it than at a combat training center. JPMRC is epicenter of interoperability right now. Its ability to be agile, to modernize with equipment rapidly, to innovate rapidly on the terrain at which we would be expected to do it, throughout the region, the amount of flexibility and opportunity that's happening out here in the Pacific right now, I can't overstate how much opportunity there is. If you want to be a part of something exciting, this is it. And our mission to provide ready brigades forward in the region so that the theater commander can employ them as he sees fit. We're not just building the readiness, we're employing the readiness in the region at the invite of our partners and our allies throughout the region. Couldn't be more proud to be a part of this team. I think it's the greatest team in the world, not just the United States Army, but JPMRC out here in the Pacific and United States Army Pacific, and I'm proud to be a part of it. At JPMRC, we are also making a huge push through what we call Forged in the Pacific. It's a YouTube channel where we're putting our AARs, where we're putting clips of lessons learned that soldiers are doing interviews with our team. Our team's doing interviews with soldiers and asking them about it. It's short clips. We're then using those clips not only from YouTube, but putting them on Instagram, the 196th Infantry Brigade's Instagram and United States Army Pacific Instagram. And so we're using those venues, right, to help share some of these lessons learned.
Sir, thank you for your time today and sharing your insights with our audience.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity today. Again, thanks, Jeremy. Thanks, Paige.
Today, we discuss lessons learned from the Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Center. You can see all of Call's resources available by going to www.army.mil/call. There you can see print and digital publications available for download on our CAC-enabled site. Some products related to today's discussion include JPMRC Post-Exercise Reports 2601, 2401, 2301, and 2302. Transformation and Contact Reports include Call's observations on TIC 1.0 and observations on Spectrum Blitz and Combined Result. Be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast and follow us on social media. If you have trouble finding information on our website, use the Request for Information tab and receive direct feedback from an analyst at Call. Finally, if you have a best practice to submit or a capability gap that requires a .mil PF solution, submit observations directly to Call using the Quickfire portal on our website. I would like to thank all of our Call team members and our show's producer, Ms. Paige Cox. Thank you for listening to Call's podcast, Insights from the Fight. We are dedicated to providing you with the insights you need to lead, train, and fight today and in the future. Join us next time for another podcast discussion on lessons learned from the force.